Good morning, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Divorce Friday. Chris, TGIDF.
TGIDF. You've trained me to say that, you know, and it's taken me a long time to remember the order of these of that acronym. I guess I feel a little bit like, you know, a former president. I must be a genius.
There you go. So TGIF, everybody, that's thank goodness it's Divorce Friday. And we are back again for another episode of our child support series, where we are doing a deep dive into the new 2021 child support guidelines. And we're nearing the end, but that doesn't mean it's any less important, because this is a really important topic we have today, talking about alimony and the intersection of alimony and child support and how they relate to each other. And we have an awesome guest speaker with us today, Kate Blake, an attorney, who Chris will tell us more about. I'm Diane Pappas. I am a certified divorce financial analyst and a certified Quadro specialist. And my practice, Solutions for Divorce, is in Gloucester, Massachusetts.
And I'm Chris Chen. I'm a certified financial planner and a CDFA also in Newton, Mass. And today our guest is Kate Blake. She is an attorney and a partner at Atwood & Cherney in Boston. She is licensed both in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and she litigates, and she also does out-of-court resolutions with mediation and collaborative law. So welcome, Kate. Thank you for joining us here.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So today, as Diane was talking about, is that we're going to address the intersection of child support and alimony. So a lot of people who do get child support can also get alimony, but certainly not everyone, and we'll address how that works. So perhaps the place that we can start with is to see if we can dispel some myth about what is an alimony case. A lot of people think about alimony differently than the way that lawyers and the courts think about it. So Kate, what is an alimony case?
Sure. So the big thing to keep in mind is that alimony is for the support of a spouse. It's much different than child support. And typically when we look at cases to see if the, you know, if it is going to be an alimony case, we look at are both parties working, and then whether or not there is a discrepancy in their income and how big that discrepancy is. We also want to know whether or not the person who has the lower income has a need for alimony, and then as well as if there's an ability to pay by the person with the higher income.
Okay, so I think one of the critical aspects here is the need and the ability to pay. And that is, these are two concepts that are not very well understood, I think. So tell us, what is a need and what is an ability to pay?
So need, so everybody who's going through divorce, especially in Massachusetts, has to fill out a financial statement. And I always hear from clients that that's one of the most difficult things that they have to do. And they don't want to, you know, they wonder how accurate it needs to be. It's a snapshot in time, and it's very important not just to get your income and your assets and your liabilities, to put down your expenses, because that's really where we look to for need. What is your living expenses? How much does it cost to run your household? And then the other kind of magic words that we talk about with alimony is, what is your marital standard of living? And that again gets down to what your expenses are.
Right.
And this is like a running theme, right, Chris? I mean, in almost every episode that we've done, it kind of comes down to expenses, because that need really is very important. Right. And, you know, when it's child support, you really want to understand what it's going to cost to stay in your home, what your children's expenses are, so that you can really understand, you know, is child support going to be enough? And then, but especially with alimony, we need to somehow establish the need.
Right. And so I think it's important to point that expenses really are important. It's possibly the most difficult aspect of the financial statement to fill, because for a lot of people, when it comes to assets and liability, all you need to do is check statements, right? And for income, you just check your pay stub, and you could get, you know, like 95% of the information you need from these documents. For expenses, you actually need to compile it. And it's a pain in the rear end. It's difficult. It's not fun, right? But it needs to be done. And the thing about it is that it needs to be done not just for the financial statement, but it is also the basis for your post-divorce financial recovery, if you will. You need to understand where you're at in order to know where you want to be going.
Absolutely. I would add in too, just as an example, you want to know very early on if you're going to be able to stay on your spouse's health insurance. Because if you don't have health insurance available to you post-divorce, that goes very much to your need and any claim that you have for alimony.
Mm-hmm. So basically, we're saying that the expenses, the person's budget through the year forms a basis of his or her need. Right? How about ability to pay?
So that's a great question. So ability to pay. I don't know that we look quite to income and expenses. Well, we don't look to expenses quite the same we do with need, because, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, when you're now taking one household and making it into two, I think both budgets are generally stretched for that. But, you know, the courts look at a person's gross income, and that's what support is based on when you're looking at ability to pay.
Yep. And that's a hard nut to swallow for a lot of people, because they say, but that's not what I take home. Right. But, you know, again, we still look at ability to pay it. We want to make sure that obviously that the payor has enough income to support a rent, you know, if they have to rent an apartment or whatever, that they still have enough money to cover their own living expenses as well. So I don't think that anyone is ever going to be left with nothing. That's sometimes how they might feel, but because we have our guidelines, that doesn't happen, because we do look at ability to pay. But again, if the income is there, we use a certain percentage of it, you should be okay.
Right.
And the case law and the statutes and the guidelines all talk too about tax analysis. So even though we talk about gross income for what is going to be paid for alimony and potentially child support, I think it's often important to bring somebody like Diane or Chris into the case to do that tax analysis.
Yeah.
And by tax analysis, you mean to say that the payor, the person who will end up paying, will get less than the gross income says they are getting, right? Because they need to pay taxes and other costs, and so we need to figure out what the end result really is.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what I always look at, and I just did this yesterday for a client, I was fooling around with some different alimony numbers to see what the net after-tax cash flow looks like for both parties. Because that, you know, so that's not really covered under the statute that we, you know, we have to look at that, but it's analysis that we do take into consideration to say, you know, how do we make sure that after taxes and after your expenses that you still have money left over. I mean, if there's a negative $1,000, $2,000 every month, then we have a problem on both sides. So they're obviously spending way above their means too. So we have to be careful of that.
Right. You know? And I think something that I think we forgot to really address why it is important to do that tax analysis thing is that it used to be that alimony was deductible for the payor, and it was taxable to the recipient, at which time we did one kind of tax analysis. And now, thanks to the TCJA that was passed in 2017, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the alimony is no longer tax deductible to the payor, and is no longer taxable to the recipient. And what that does is that it throws things a little bit out of whack in terms of considering what the recipient is actually getting and what the payor is actually paying, which is why there is a need for analysis.
Yeah.
So there is another concept that a lot of people come to all of us with, to UK, to Diane and I also, and they come with the idea, with the concept that their lifestyle, the point of the whole thing is that they should be equalizing post-divorce lifestyle. It's either that they should keep their lifestyle from before the divorce, or that they shouldn't have a worse lifestyle than their ex-spouse. So how how does the law, how do the courts look at that these days?
So that is really what the law looks at, is what is your marital standard of living? And they try and as best they can keep both parties in that standard of living. But the reality of, as I mentioned, taking one household and now making it into two with the same dollars, it often does result in a decrease in both parties' standard of living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and so people, you know, that's again, another really hard concept for people. But having gone through my own divorce, you know, again, there was only so much money. So I had to cut some things out. You know, even though in my standard of living, I may have taken some vacations, you know, maybe a couple, I couldn't take a couple vacations a year anymore. Maybe I had a house cleaner. Well, maybe I can't do that anymore. So, you know, things like that, you just have to, there's again, like you said, there's only so much money that can go around. And at some point you have to cut back. Your lifestyle is going to change. So that's really hard when the courts say, you know, we want to try to keep the same standard of living when we know that's next to impossible unless you're making a lot of money.
Right, exactly. So we've been talking about alimony there for a bit for the past 10 minutes or so. And let's remember that we're really supposed to be talking about child support. Mm-hmm. And so typically, in a normal case, a conventional case, we want to consider child support before we even talk about that alimony concept. And so you were talking earlier about how alimony is to support the spouse and how child support is to support the children. So what happens in... let me just step another step back, right? And we're also looking at a certain level of income, like the first $400,000 in joint income should be considered for child support. So what happens when child support is not enough for the recipient? Like say it is a stay-at-home mom, as an example, and she is not going to be able to get income to support herself and all she's getting is child support.
So this is something that we've been struggling with even before these new child support guidelines came out. And with the increase from 250 per year combined income to 400 per year combined income, I think a lot of practitioners are just looking at kind of quote unquote, the easy way to deal with the cases. We're just going to call it all child support and be done with it. But to your point, Chris, that doesn't recognize, especially somebody who has been out of the workforce, maybe trying to get back in, they certainly do have that need for an alimony order. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the child support guidelines take into account the type of parenting schedule. So if you have a case like that, where the recipient is now perhaps sharing custody, which is going to result in a lower amount of child support than it would be if they were having primary custody, you really should be looking at whether or not an alimony amount would be appropriate. And then the question becomes, how do you go about calculating that? Because the alimony statute, and I think this is something that the task force struggled with, it is addressed in some of their commentary. The alimony statute says that to the extent income is being used for child support purposes, it should not then be used for alimony purposes. So that's something that needs to be looked at as well. The other thing that I would want to say that absolutely case specific and should be calculated into this factor, into this analysis, is the length of time that somebody might be paying child support versus the length of time that somebody may be paying alimony. Sometimes I have cases where parties, neither one of them really wants to have to come back in for a modification, and perhaps they know that the children are going to be emancipating in a few years, but potentially that alimony amount could go on much longer. So they're agreeing in that instance that perhaps we're going to call it an unallocated amount or call it all alimony. And that way nobody has to come back in on a modification absent some extreme circumstances, such as somebody losing their job once those children emancipate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. No, that's a good way to handle it for sure.
So I was just thinking about some of the things that you said there. So we're looking there at a combined income of $400,000, which happens reasonably often in Massachusetts, But most people still make less than $400,000 combined. And essentially what it does is that it sort of leaves the stay-at-home parents, the underemployed parents, and so on, a little bit out in the cold with respect to their post-divorce income. And so in these kind of cases, should alimony apply anyway, like maybe a rehabilitative kind of alimony instead of general alimony?
That's absolutely a possibility. So those types of, rather than general term, shorter term alimony, like a rehabilitative alimony, which is usually 2 to 5 years, it's kind of looked at as something to get somebody back on their feet, back into the workforce, perhaps do some type of training. And maybe the payor spouse is willing to pay a little bit more, knowing that that's going to help that spouse get back on their feet.
Right. I mean, I think we've talked about in some of the previous episodes where I've had examples of people who would be going back to school, like to I mentioned nurse practitioners and an engineer, but also to even like a community college to get a radiology certificate or something like that, right? And so that's something that would enable these people to get back into the workforce and get real income, if you will, right?
Yeah, so in that case, would we be calculating alimony first?
So this is an interesting concept. Maybe we should introduce what alimony first is first. Diane, you go for it.
Sure. So the new guidelines do say that alimony can be calculated first. And referring back to what Kate or Chris, I don't remember which one said it, that what the support income that's used for one, whether it's child support, cannot then be used for alimony. So you have to use different sets of income or different amounts. So if we calculate alimony first, that means we run through the guidelines and we do that tax analysis to find the tax equivalent alimony figure that we were talking about previously. And then what we're going to do is we're going to add that alimony to the recipient's income, and we're going to subtract that alimony payment from the payor's income. So now we've taken care of that issue there of double dipping in income. And then now we can calculate child support. So that's when we say we're going to run it. So the guidelines say we can do child support first, we can do alimony first, and see what comes out with the best economic result for that family. So that's the question. So when we're looking at alimony, should we be calculating it first?
Kate, what do you think?
The typical lawyer answer, it depends.
Yes. Yep.
Shame on you.
I think that's why the guidelines, and you know, this concept has always been around. It's just that every time we do the new child support guidelines, it comes back up. And as Fern Froland said, she goes, it was never, the child support was the guidelines were never meant that the recipient gets the dregs, you know, what the leftover income, whatever is left over, you can get an alimony. That was never never their idea or their concept when it came to child support versus alimony, that it shouldn't get the second fiddle. You know, like we really need to, in some cases, look at the difference between doing alimony first and doing child support first and see what benefits the family, what works for both parties, right, in a better way.
So at the last go around, last time that we changed the child support guidelines 4 years ago, the child support figures that came out of there were actually lower than the previous ones. And so the concept of doing alimony first was rampant at that time. And I think there was a lot of at least people trying to apply it. And what seems to have happened is after a while, we all got tired of it and we went back to child support first.
Seems to happen.
So it seems that part of the challenge is that it is difficult. It's a difficult concept for people to get. In fact, it's a difficult concept for the courts to deal with. Mm-hmm. Right? So if we're talking about alimony first, is that practical? Is that something that will last more than a few months? Mm-hmm.
You've got to look at how long it's going to last, and then the child support as well.
Mm-hmm. So what I mean is the concept of doing alimony first, is that concept going to, survive, if you will? I know it's a bad word in our context.
I think it is something that will survive. I do, because you can't ignore the fact that there are people who are in need of the alimony, and then there are also the children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think because we raised the income to 400, I think that is a huge increase, and I think that's why we really do need to look at alimony first. And you know, for like Chris and I to run that calculation, it's not that difficult to do per se. But it would really be helpful to the attorneys and the judge because they're asking for these. And I think so that really makes it, when you have the information, the reports in front of you, I think you can make a much better judgment as to what's going to work best for that family.
Right.
Even if it means, you know, it might mean a little more work, but just because I think what happens is when we say the word tax reports or things like that, our clients, they might, you know, their heads start to spin or they might freak out. Oh my gosh, what's that going to cost? But it's not as complicated as it sounds. It really isn't.
And it's so fact specific, it's worthwhile just to look at those numbers and see what they come out to be.
Right, we're not pulling numbers out of thin air. You know, these are all based on fact. And so therefore it's hard to argue it because you're looking at a tax calculation and a report that really gives you a very good, clear understanding of what you're doing, whether it's alimony first or child support first.
Yeah, so perhaps we should go a little bit into what does a tax report, what does a tax analysis provide, really? It's, I think one of the reasons that people shy away from it is that it's sort of nebulous. It sounds sort of esoteric, and they don't really know what they're getting out of it.
Right.
So well, they get out of it.
Well, in very simple terms, when you have software that does this, and you put in the income, you put in the expenses, and based on other information that you're putting in, the number of children you have, the filing status, things of that nature, then the software can calculate the tax that you would owe on your income. So that the reason that's a tax analysis. It's calculating the tax. It's also taking into account things like child deduction or child tax credits, maybe educational credits, other things like that, your filing status. And then it may also, if you put this information in, if someone has a mortgage and they're deducting their mortgage interest, all those things impact the taxes on your income. And so a tax analysis is just putting all the right information in there, the right assumptions, the right data, and then seeing what the resulting tax is on that income. And then you have your net after-tax income. That's what you have to meet your obligations, your monthly household and all these, you know, children's expenses and everything. And then that, if it's negative, we have some problems. If it's positive, way positive on one side and negative on the other, we still have problems. We have to try to shift that a little. So that's what a basic tax analysis is. It's actually quite simple.
So do you see that people are receptive to this kind of concept, or do their eyes really glaze over and they want to, die for safety?
When I do it, my biggest thing is educating the client and explaining it to them and going through it line by line. And when they see that, they understand it. Mm-hmm. I just think it's when you throw that word tax analysis, that's when it's like, oh, you know, I don't know what that means.
It sounds horrible.
It does.
I would rather go to court. Okay.
Get your teeth pulled or something.
So, Kate, do you see a lot of tax analysis being presented in the kind of work that you do, or is it something that is usually skipped?
It really depends on what the case is. You know, if it's somebody who's looking, if there's an agreement to just do child support, you know, the guidelines are the guidelines. It's only when you really start talking about these situations where you have a stay-at-home spouse usually, and then there's more than one children more often, then it certainly becomes a question. It was easier to have this discussion when we were able to have part of it be deductible, the alimony under the old tax scenario. Because clients, I think, were able to wrap their head around that better. it's more difficult to talk now about, you know, explaining the benefit of it, but I absolutely think that there is a benefit to that in the right scenario, especially in the higher income and cases. Well, I mean, I think it's probably across the board, but some of the higher incomes where you start getting into that 400,000, because now you're not able to shift that income the way we were when we were able to have it be deductible alimony. And so now you have a real big discrepancy in what tax brackets people are in.
Yep. Yep. And that's what you have to look at is the tax bracket, because that's going to change the alimony number. So for people out there, when we're talking about this and the effect of the TCJA, that Tax and Cat and Jobs Act, we are trying to find the tax equivalent alimony compared to what it was before the tax cut and what it is now. And so when you have different, you know, whatever it was when we run some ratios like 32.5, we look at what it was then. And what we need to do is find the tax equivalent of what it is now. And so that's the challenge there. And it's not a difficult calculation to make, but that it is one extra step that we have to do. And hopefully someday Massachusetts will change those percentages so that we don't have to do this additional step. But that is what, it's amazing the tax impact that alimony, the deductibility had. And it made it easier for the payor to pay alimony, knowing that they were gonna have their taxes reduced significantly if it was a large number for alimony.
In fact, John Fisk, who is a prominent mediator around here, used to call it the greatest tax deduction.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. And if you have a contested case and you have a judge making these decisions, if you don't have that tax analysis, quite often you're going to end up with the middle of the road 25%.
Right.
That may be the appropriate amount, but you won't know that unless that's you do the analysis. But 25% could be way off.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure Chris, you and I have done these calculations and it ranges anywhere from 16 to 29. Because again, it really depends on the tax bracket and the income of both parties.
It depends on the other tax situation that they have. I mean, it's not just income, an income issue, it's an income and other deduction issues. So. Yes. Yeah. But something that's so we've talked about it in the of everything there in the context of having child support in the up to $400,000 of joint income. But so what happens, Kate, what happens when the income is over $400,000, when the joint income is over $400,000? Should that additional income also be considered for child support, or should we reserve it for other things such as alimony?
So the old guidelines, and the new guidelines both talk about anything above 400 is discretionary as to how the court is going to do it. When the guidelines were capped at 250, I often saw courts and attorneys plugging the excess income that came out at the bottom and putting it back in. And I think with these new guidelines, it's been very clear that that's not the appropriate way to handle that.
Correct.
And that what would be more appropriate is having a discussion about alimony or a percentage of that being paid as additional child support, depending upon the circumstances.
Yeah, no, it's funny. Fern Frohlin said they never intended for that number to be run back through the guidelines. So I'm glad they clarified that.
I am too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think it was very common to do that, right? And so... And I think when you have income that is in excess of $400,000, I mean, theoretically, there is a fair amount of money to go around, right? I mean, no one likes to pay, but there is money to go around. So
yeah, I mean, and that money can be significant, Chris, as you know, and Kate, as we know, it could be in the form of commission or bonus income that we can't lump into the initial 400 because it's a variable. It could be RSU income from stock options and things. So you know, I have come to up against some cases where that number is higher than the 400, you know, than the number being allocated to the 400 for child support. So then you have a significant amount of money afterwards, after that combined income.
And I was going to say that sometimes when you see that level of excess income, then we really start getting into discussion with alimony about a person's reasonable need, the recipient's reasonable need, and what is that reasonable need? Was this the way they always lived their lifestyle, or was this extra quote unquote income that they use to then create marital assets.
Right. Yeah. And, or is this, you know, is there a history of getting this kind of income, right? You know, if this is new income because the employee has a new job, you know, they might argue, well, I never had this income during our marriage, so why should I have to pay it now? That's a very common thing, you know, and so sometimes they put caps on it. And yep. So that becomes very subjective.
Caps and a sliding percentage I see a lot of.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, I've seen a lot of caps on, especially on the executive comp income.
Yes.
Meaning stock options, RSUs, and so on, where the amount that would be end up being paid as alimony ends up being less than the standard alimony.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So also there goes something that I think is unexplored, right? Not discussed enough, is that I think there is a difference between the income that is counted for child support and the income that is counted for alimony. I think by and large for child support, everything is included. In fact, I think it was number 29 or 30 in the list is other.
As always.
Yep.
As always. But some of these incomes are not counted for alimony, right? Is that something that is commonly considered?
I think that the court has much more discretion about what they can exclude, and parties have much a better ability to negotiate that and define gross income how they want to define it. To Diane's point, you know, if this is a brand new job and they had never received any type of equity compensation in the past, you know, there is an argument that that is that spouse's own effort and work post-marriage. So should the other spouse be entitled to share a percentage of it, or is it going to be excluded completely from the definition of income? On the flip side, if you're narrowly defining, you could potentially have somebody who's going out and structuring their compensation in such a way to deprive the other spouse of receiving anything.
Right. But then the argument can also be that if, let's say it's a long, I don't know, like an 18 or 20 year marriage, right? And you have that, the argument could be, well, I was there in the home for that long, enabling you to get to this point of the pinnacle of your career, and now we're getting divorced.
Exactly.
So there is a case, there's a story for both sides. It's so hard.
Absolutely.
I mean, getting back to that exec comp example, so you were saying, so if someone ends up getting some stock options and whatnot after the divorce, that there's an argument that it should be excluded from alimony calculations, yet it should still be included in the child support calculations. And what that does is that it increases the percentage of income that is being paid by that person for child support, right? But excluded from alimony. And so it's, right. it's actually pretty complicated.
It is. Yep. And, you know, that's why we're trying to have these discussions, even though, again, as we know, every case is different and you have to look at the factors in each of these cases. And sometimes you're not going to be able to get the job done in mediation, you know, because the factors are complex, and we need someone like Kate, you know, to help, you know, in court or wherever, out of court, to try to negotiate these things. But, these are difficult concepts, and, a lot of our cases, especially now too, because, you know, 20 years ago, we didn't have a lot of RSUs and ISOs. We didn't have a lot of this executive comp, but now we have in Massachusetts, a lot of technology companies that are doing that. So I think that's why we're seeing such a huge spike in this type of income, is because of the industries that we have here in Massachusetts, which is, you know, it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I think there are some other factors like the boom in RSUs and non-qualified options is really a thing of this century.
Yeah,
it wasn't that much the last century. Last century we had the incentive stock options mostly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the RSUs are a lot easier to calculate too, so I like them.
I think they work a lot better actually in many ways. I mean, of course, it's an issue because of the way that they are taxed, right? And then sometimes people don't like it, especially at the higher income. But, you know, I like to tell people that if they're taxed, it means they made money, so it's okay.
Kate, what about, you know, we're getting back to like stock options. So someone who has significant stock options, and the party's incomes are very close. So we have, I have some high earners. Their incomes are not that far apart. They're way over the 400 combined. The one child is in college, one's about to go to college. And so in that particular case where there is substantial income above the 400, have you seen where that maybe the payor's income is specifically used to pay for college?
Absolutely. That it should be recognized in some respect with the kids' expenses in some manner. You know, if kids were younger, maybe they're prepaying or prefunding a 529 account. That might be a way to do it as well. When courts decide who's going to pay for college and in what proportion, they don't just look at income, but they also look at assets. So if somebody has been divorced for a while and they've been able to use that excess income in order to create assets, that could be used as well.
Right. And I think it's also an easier, I'm going to say, nut to swallow again, because it's your children. Because a lot of, you know, the other side, the argument for the payor is, you know, she's making a lot of money too. Why do I need to pay alimony? But yet we have all this income above the 400, which is a history. It's been that way in the marriage, you know, for the last five or some odd years. It's a, you know, a 30-year marriage. And again, they're at the pinnacle of their careers, the height of their career. So we have to address that income somehow. And as kind of, you know, put it somewhere.
Right. Put it somewhere.
Put it somewhere.
Okay. So we seem to have covered a whole bunch of stuff on alimony. What did we not cover?
I don't know. Kate, do you want to share maybe some examples, some cases that you've had or in the past or lately that?
Yeah, I also wanted to mention, and I know it's mentioned in the new guidelines too, the case of Calvin C versus Amelia A.
Yes, excellent.
So sometimes we have cases where the higher wage earner is the one who actually has custody of the children. And so then you have child support going one way and alimony being paid another way. As I think Chris mentioned, I'm licensed in New Hampshire. In New Hampshire, we have a very easy way to deal with that. We run the child support and then we adjust the incomes based on that child support, and then we calculate alimony. It's a very straight forward calculation. This Calvin C versus Amelia A case, the court basically said that you run the alimony and you run the child support and then you net the number. And they're calling them reciprocal orders. And that they reserved comment on what you would do if it was both both alimony and child support, going back to our earlier discussion today. So I think that's an important case to think of when you have that type of situation.
Right. So instead of money going from the one person paying child support, so in this case, the wife paying child support or the mother to the father, and the father paying alimony to the mother, you're going to net it. So there's only one payment going to somebody.
Right.
Okay. Yep.
Go ahead. Sorry, Jen.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So to Diane's question about cases that I've seen. So I recently had a case, we were negotiating it before the guidelines came out. And we were talking about, it was three children, the primary parent stayed at home, really didn't have much of an income. Husband's income conveniently was at 400 a year, and then he had additional income. So initially we were talking about how are we going to structure this. And the other interesting thing about that case is the child support was probably going to terminate a little bit before alimony, but not too much beforehand. But it raises the question, and we should remind people that child support is paid until a child is emancipated in Massachusetts. That's age 18, unless they're principally dependent upon a parent, and then it goes to age 21, unless they're enrolled in college full time, and then it will terminate upon college graduation or age 23, whichever occurs first. Mm-hmm. Alimony, the law says, if you're under a marriage of 20 years, there's a durational limit in the alimony statute. If you're over 20 years, it's considered lifetime alimony. But once somebody reaches Social Security full retirement age, there's a presumption that they'll be entitled to stop. And then it ends upon either party's death or the recipient's remarriage. So I tell people, never say never, people will get remarried. So that those are things that you want to be thinking about as you're trying to reach an agreement in your case. So in this case, where we had alimony and child support somewhat terminating around the same time, it still made sense to call some of it alimony and some of it child support because the recipient spouse was in need of that. And so when the new guidelines came out and with husband's income being 400, it almost helped us resolve that case more easily because we decided to do child support on the full 400 and then additional income was going to be considered for alimony purposes. And then they conveniently were going to terminate around the same amount of time. But if the recipient spouse went out and remarried, the additional income was going to go away, but we still have that base child support amount. So there wasn't going to be a need for them to come back into court or back to mediation to try and modify it.
Yeah, right. I just had a question and it came into my head and went out of my head, which happens a lot.
Happens to all of us.
I know, but it, I'll think about it. I'll remember it. But yeah, that's an interesting case. Oh, I know what I was going to say. When you were running those numbers under the 2018 child support guidelines, were you getting a higher amount of total support or less than running them under the new guidelines? Like was the support, the total support, meaning child support and alimony, was it the same or was one higher than the other?
So when we were doing 250 plus the additional 250 to 400, I think we were probably around 25%. It only ended up being a difference of, I want to say, maybe $10 a week when you jumped into the 2021 guidelines of the full 400. Where it became significant was when children started to emancipate. So it was three children and then it dropped off. I want to say when it went down to two children, it might've dropped down to the total amount, like 12,000 a year. And then when it got down to the one child left, that was going to be a reduction of $30,000.
Wow. Yeah.
Hey, this brings to my mind the question I had about unallocated alimony. So unallocated alimony is supposed to be child support and alimony bundled together. And in the past, it was a way to, it was basically a way to make child support tax deductible to the payor. So now it's not an option anymore anyway. But it seems that for people who are going to have child support and relatively soon, that it would make a lot of sense rather than having them go back to court to say, okay, child support is now done, let's do some alimony, right?
Absolutely. I recently had a case like that where the oldest child was going into college and the youngest was a few years away from college. And at that point we thought, let's just call it all. We did end up calling it all alimony. But it could have easily been called unallocated support as well, since we don't have the tax issue. Mm-hmm. And that way they both know that even though everything related to children is always modifiable, they both generally had peace of mind that nobody was going to be coming back into court and doing this all over again once a child emancipates or goes off to college.
So is that really the benefit of as labeling it as unallocated is so that it can go to the longer durational limit, you know, whether it's because if alimony is going to be a longer duration, if we put it that way as to unallocated, that allows it to continue that way and not have to be modified when the kids emancipate.
Correct. So you define what the termination is there.
Mm-hmm. So that makes it a little easier, but that really works when the kids are much closer, you know, to college.
It does, because if you have young kids there, I mean, that's why they leave things modifiable, because you don't know what circumstances are going to be 10 years down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should that be sort of a best practice, if you will, that if you have that kind of circumstance that you should call it unallocated?
I think practitioners need to be keeping in mind termination dates when they're looking at support scenarios.
Because there is a reverse scenario where child support is going to run much longer than alimony. That happens, I think, when people have young children.
Yeah.
And effectively, it works sort of the same way, especially now with the new guidelines, because the payments are a bit higher than they used to be.
Especially if those kids are young and there's daycare expenses.
Oh, yes, that can really be an issue. Right. Okay, cool. So are there other things that we should cover? What if child support is not enough? What should people do?
That is a question that I wish I had an answer to, because I probably could retire what I'm doing now if I knew how to make more money for people. I mean, it is definitely a struggle. I think the courts recognize that it's a struggle, but at the end of the day, you know, judges are running support and that's it. And they expect people to try and basically figure it out themselves.
Yeah. I mean, we've had this conversation again, you know, on this podcast series. You know, there's only two ways to make it work. You either bring in more income or you reduce your expenses.
Both. And
what's that?
Or both.
Or both. But yeah, that's hard. It is difficult for some families out there. But that's really the only choice we have. So.
I mean, it is difficult. I mean, and obviously the answers to that will be individual to each family.
Right. So. Yeah, but that's also when emotions, you know, like sometimes you have to look at the numbers and just acknowledge, you know, and accept the fact that, okay, in order for me to survive and be happy with my kids, I'm going to have to be able to live within my means. And that's the worst thing is to be living outside of your means, you know, struggling from paycheck or alimony or child support check to, you know, the next check, because that trickles down to the children. And if you're unhappy, then the children are going to be unhappy. So, you know, that's a hard situation. And it's, you know, getting rid of that emotional, you know, issue that comes with a divorce.
I mean, it's a big challenge for many people, because when they are the recipient and they see the payor living a nice life and they don't, then, you know, it has all kinds of impacts that are not good.
Right.
Yeah, you could do a whole episode on how the housing market has impacted people's ability to, quote unquote, live within their means, because if they're going to sell that, if they understand they can't afford their house and they're going to sell it, then it becomes a question of, well, what can they afford and what is out there? And right now, sometimes it is better to stay where they are because it's going to be cheaper than even renting something.
Yep. No, we had that conversation as well, that the rental around here and, you know, Boston, the greater Boston area, North Metro West, you know, it's the rent payments for a 1-2 bedroom apartment or townhouse are higher than the mortgage.
Yep.
That the people currently have. So that's not going to work. And then we had the discussion, okay, then maybe you have to move further out, you know, out beyond 128 or out beyond, you know, which then,
you know, it's only so far that people can go.
Iowa
is not driving distance to the job market.
Right. Exactly.
And so, how does that impact parenting plans?
Right.
Oh yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. We have those too. Yeah. Those are all like different. Those are all podcasts in of themselves.
Yep.
Okay, cool. So it looks like we've pretty much addressed the subject today. And I forgot at the beginning of the podcast to give our information. So we have a website, divorcefriday.com, and the podcast is finally starting to get distributed through the normal channel. I believe it's on Google, Pandora, and Spotify at this point. And if you have found us on the Facebook page, please like the Facebook page. And if you have found us on Twitter, please like Twitter. And if you need to contact us, if you have questions, you are free to do so. The email address is divorcefriday@gmail.com. And it goes to both Diane and I. All right. Yep. So at this time, We'll also want to add the normal caveat that this is a podcast, and so it is general information. It may or may not apply to your specific case. If you are having issues that we've talked about, please talk to a professional. There's nothing that can replace that, unfortunately. And at this point, I think we are pretty much at the end, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk for a lot longer, but no, I think we did tackle in a very good way, in an easy to understand way, the interplay between child support and alimony.
Excellent.
And so you might have to listen to this podcast a couple of times and take notes.
I'll have to listen to it a couple of times.
I will too.
but Kate, we want to thank you very much for joining us here. It's been great. And we look forward to running to each other at different events now that the pandemic is over, or maybe not. I don't know.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Kate, for coming to joining us today. It was great.
Okay. All right. Goodbye, guys.
All right. Bye.